all right, if I can't use the 1.56 value anymore, what one number do I put in its place? What divides clean from dirty? What divides acceptable from unacceptable? And, you know, as you said, we're to the point of there's no one-size-fits-all cleanliness requirement. It's simply too complex for that.
That's my guest, Doug Pauls, next on Reliability Matters.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques, with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
Welcome to another episode of Reliability Matters. There's been much anticipation and speculation regarding proposed changes to the IPC cleanliness testing standards. The historical pass-fail limits adopted by the electronic assembly industry were established more than 40 years ago. Circuit assemblies have changed radically over the past four-plus decades, necessitating the need to reevaluate cleanliness standards to make them more relevant to today's assemblies and component designs and uses. The good news is there's no need to throw out your existing cleanliness testing machine or process. One simply has to document its effectiveness. How do we do that? We went to the chairman of the IPC task force responsible for updating the new cleanliness assessment standard. Doug Pauls and his self-named Rhino team traveled deep into the weeds to design a method of determining how clean is clean enough. For those few in the electronic assembly industry who don't know Doug, he is a principal materials and process engineer at Collins Aerospace, formerly Rockwell Collins. Doug has been associated with IPC for 34 years, and he was inducted into the IPC Hall of Fame in 2017. Doug is presently the chairman of the Conformal Coating Requirements Task Group and was general chairman of IPC's cleaning and coating committees for 10 years. I would like to go on about Doug's accomplishments, but that would take the entire podcast. So instead, I'll welcome Doug Pauls to the podcast. Many thanks for joining me today, Doug.
You're welcome.
So let's start by getting into a little bit about you. Tell me a little bit about your background. What led you to Collins Aerospace, which very recently was known as Rockwell Collins?
Correct. Well, I have a background in chemistry and physics from Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Then I got my bachelor's in electrical engineering from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. My first job was working as a federal civil servant for the Department of the Navy at the Naval Avionics Center in Indianapolis. I was there for about 9 years, and that was what started my path towards material science and away from electrical engineering. Next job I was at about 8 years. I was technical director of a small laboratory and consulting firm, Contamination Studies Labs, which is now Foresight. And while working there, did a lot of work using ion chromatography to troubleshoot manufacturing processes to figure out where were the cleanliness-related faults and how do we fix them. Then a little over 18 years ago, I was looking for a change, and my friend and colleague, Dave Hillman at Rockwell Collins, he and I talked, and I ended up here. And so I've been part of the Advanced Operations Engineering Group here at Rockwell for the last 18 years, and I serve as our company's a principal expert on call on both cleaning and cleanliness and conformal coating. So that's kind of the journey in a nutshell.
Can you be assured that the contamination issues Collins Aerospace might face only occur 8 to 5 when you say you're on call, or does that happen 24/7?
My cell phone number and my email are well known to a wide variety of people here. So I've gotten calls late at night. I've gotten calls on the weekend, but that's what they pay me for. So
there you go. Okay. Well, in addition to your duties at Collins Aerospace, you've been deeply involved with IPC for 34 years and are presently the chair of the conformal coating requirements task group, and you've served as the general chair for IPC's cleaning and coating committees. For our listeners who aren't part of the electronics industry, since this podcast goes a little bit wider than that, IPC is an industry trade group, an advocacy group, which also, through an industry collaborative process, establishes and publishes standards for our industry. So how did you become involved with IPC, Doug?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story. In my first job at Naval Avionics, one of my first mentors was Susan Mancilla, who also ended up in the IPC's Hall of Fame. And she had told me that if I really wanted to understand specs and standards and understand the fine points of what separated a quality assembly from a problem assembly, then I needed to be involved with the specification drafting process. And so she took me to my first IPC meeting, which, if I recall, was the fall of 1985, back when mammoths roamed the earth. And she got me involved with Roger Landolt, who at the time was the chairman of the cleaning and coating committees, and he was also the leader of the solder mask task group. And Susan told Roger that, you know, Doug here is one of our new engineers, takes exceptionally good notes. So Roger asked if I would take notes for the meeting, which I did. I handed him over. If you recall at that time, you know, we didn't have the word processors, electronic stuff that we do today. And you got the minutes, the next IPC meeting in printed and bound form. I took a look at the minutes and lo and behold, it had me listed as the vice chair of the solder mask task group.
Which news to you,
was
huh?
Kind of news. It was news to me, yeah. So I looked at Roger and said, "What's this?" And they said, "Oh, didn't they tell you? That's how you become an IPC chairman." So that's what started me along the road towards that. And I've always found the IPC to be a very good school. It's taught me a lot about the very fine points of what separates a quality assembly from a problem assembly. And I've made exceptional contacts throughout the industry in all of those years. So oftentimes my value to my employer, if I don't know the answer, I got a pretty good idea who does. So IPC, you know, to kind of paraphrase an old Saturday Night Live skit, IPC been very, very good to me.
Very good. I think you started this industry in 85. So did I. I'm almost embarrassed to say I came from another industry. So my first experience in this industry was in the soldering equipment business, selling soldering machines. And I remember my first question to my boss was, how does a solder know where to stick? So certainly I've come a long way, and IPC and SMTA have been a great help in that process in an environment where it's safe to ask questions like that.
So yes, it is.
So today we're going to talk about the highly anticipated, drumroll notwithstanding, J Standard 001G Amendment 1. But before we get into that, let's just get into a little bit of background. Let's talk about cleaning and actually more specifically cleanliness assessment. You and I have shared numerous stages speaking at symposium and conferences around the world, and we've agreed in our meetings that there has been a long need to rethink cleanliness assessment methods. First, I should say, just as a matter of record, not that it really matters, I'm really not comfortable with the term cleanliness testing because that implies a non-contextual pass-fail expectation. I prefer to say cleanliness quantification or cleanliness assessment or ionic contamination quantification or my favorite, contamination-induced failure probability testing, which will never be used because it's too long, it's practically a sentence, and it makes a horrible acronym. But what led you to speak and then later lead the way to a new procedure to determine if an electronic assembly is clean enough?
Well, I would agree, Mike, that I don't like the term cleanliness testing either. In fact, I don't really like contamination testing because all of those terms are really emotionally charged and they can often lead to the wrong mindset. You know, I've always preferred the term residue assessment. In a manufacturing process, there are always residues on a circuit board. Some you can see, some you can't. Some are harmful and some benign. But you can't really tell which is which until you do the testing. But the residues are always there. So I usually talk about residue assessment or, the residue state of the board. That's kind of how I look at it. So what led me to take on this monumental elephant? I would say probably it's my inability to keep my big mouth shut. Back in about if you went back in the last 15, 20 years, there have been a number of papers done at both SMTA and IPC that have talked about people who have relied on ROSE testing to differentiate clean from dirty, or acceptably clean from unacceptably dirty. And it has often failed them. And so it was becoming clear as things got more dense, as standoffs got lower, that we had really reached a point where ROSE testing could no longer tell us what we wanted to know. And I have been kind of griping about it in the J Standard 1 committees, talking about how ROSE was broke and we really shouldn't be using it as a cleanliness assessment tool, when Dan Foster, who was at the time the head of the J Standard 1 group, did a fantastic job doing that. I think he got tired of hearing me gripe because he turned to me and said, "You know, Doug, you're right. Section 8 of J Standard 1 is broken and we need to fix it." Yes, we do. "Say, aren't there any IPC committees who deal with residues and their effects?" "Yes, there are." "And aren't you the chairman of the committees that cover that kind of testing?" "Yes, I am." And I could feel the noose tightening around my neck, but at this point, there was absolutely nothing I could do about it. So he said, "Wouldn't you be the logical person to lead such a revision effort?" "Yes." And so that's kind of how I ended up leading some of that. I do consider it to be somewhat ironic that I would be chosen to do that. Two of my first mentors at the Naval Avionics Center were Bob Danoon and Bill Hobson, who were the originators of the ROSE method. So if you're wondering, where did that 1.56 value come from? It came from the testing that Bob and Bill did. Now, both of them were always horrified at what the industry had done with their test method, because they had always intended it to be a process control tool and not a product acceptance tool. And so having one of their students kind of lead the charge to bring it back to what it should have been is good. Now, taking a look at that value of 1.56 that Bill and Bob came up with, that was a measure of, you know, rosin fluxes and so on. If you went back 40 years ago, you know, we were all cleaning with high solids, rosin fluxes, the RMAs or the RAs. We were all cleaning with ozone deleting materials. We really didn't understand our processes all that well. And so we're dealing today with almost a completely different situation. And we can't really say, "Well, I must be clean because I meet the spec." That original test, ROSE itself, is a time, temperature, and solubility type of equation. And the fluxes we use today, the ability to get at those flux residues, they're all vastly different. And so the time for ROSE as a product acceptance tool is gone. You know, in one of your webinars, which I greatly enjoy listening to, you do a comparison between like the electronics that are in a modern day automobile and your, is it a 1967 Mustang?
A 68 Mustang, pretty close.
68 Mustang. That's a nice car. I am envious.
I love it too.
Yeah. But there's, you know, if you compare the electronics between the two, there's really no comparison. And that's kind of the same for ROSE back then versus ROSE now. So that's kind of the history of why J Standard 1 Rev G came about.
Yeah, that's just to give the audience full transparency. We do have a horse in the roast testing race, as you know, and we've long since we bought the company that made the roast tester. I think back in 1995 or 1996, we've long told people ignore the pass fail limits that are historical standards, 1.56 per centimeter squared or 10 micrograms per square inch, because those were established back, back almost just after my car, my old 1968 Mustang was made, and electronics have changed so much. I prefer to recommend tests like that as process monitoring tools. It doesn't really matter what the number is. You could have a very low number or a very high number if the board is reliable and if it doesn't experience contamination-related failure, and you know that. It doesn't matter what the number is. It's what matters is if the number changes. If all of a sudden you go from a 3 or a 0.5, doesn't really matter, to anything higher than that, just stop the presses, look for what changed. And usually it could be traced to DI tanks on the rinse portion of your cleaner that have gone bad and nobody noticed, or someone mixed up the ratio of wash chemical from 1 in 10 to 10 in 1, and things like that. It could be a number of other things as well. Reflow profile maybe kind of whacked out, and you're burning stuff on that can't come off during a wash process. It is a flag for looking to see if anything has changed. It's not going to give you a number that can be guaranteed to produce a high reliability product free of contamination associated failure mechanisms just based on a predisposed number that was established in the 70s or early 80s. So I think we're in the same ballpark there. But I just wanted to be clear for the people who know me. Yeah, we do have a horse in that race, and no part of this podcast is ever meant to be commercial. But I didn't want people to go, wait a minute, he's got a horse in that race. So I just wanted to make that part clear. So walk me through the new standard. What changed and what...
Mike, let me back up for just a minute, though.
Sure.
You know, there was an IPC technical report, TR-583, that took a look at the repeatability and the reproducibility of ionic cleanliness testers back in the early 90s and so on. And they found that oftentimes the testers of that era were not repeatable or reproducible. Now, I've done my own evaluation of ionic cleanliness testers, all the ones that are on the market today, and I will say that they are much better today. They are repeatable. They are reproducible, yours included. That's something that I think people should keep in mind. You know, just like the roast testing, the cleanliness criteria of today are different than they were 30 years ago, so are the equipment today different from those 20 and 30 years ago.
Right. And where the equipment is going today is very different than times past, particularly with IoT. We're putting electronics in places we never intended electronics to be, on the person, in the body, in a fridge, in a toothbrush, things like that. We're putting quote-unquote cheap electronics, not class 3, not space class, yet they have to work. Not that people will die, you know, if a wearable stops working, but a reputation can die if a wearable stops working. So wearables, are among the most hazardous environments that electronics can be in, because they go on people, and people tend to go into cold, into vibration, into moisture, into heat, sometimes many times a day. And the electronics that are going with it are kind of low-end electronics. So cleanliness does matter, or reliability even more matters on these types of devices. So walk me through the new standard. What changed, and what, if anything, stays the same?
Well, okay, that's kind of a hard one to answer, but I'll give it a shot. First of all, anyone who really is looking to understand the new Amendment 1, the new protocol, should get a copy of the IPC's white paper 019A. I understand that if you order the J Standard 1G Amendment 1, that paper automatically comes with it. In fact, I am told you can't buy the amendment without getting that white paper. When our team of subject matter experts, which I've oddly called the Rhino team because I don't like the term Tiger team, we understood that there was going to have to be a lot of education that went together with this change. And so we wrote as a companion document something that paragraph by paragraph explained the spec and standards, which from what I have seen hasn't really been done before other than possibly like the J Standard 1 handbook. And so everyone should have a copy of that, and it does explain a lot of it. Most of the questions that I have fielded to date have been answered by that. Some of the lesser used provisions, like what was in there before on the non-ionic residues or ultrasonic cleaning, those were left, as it were, in previous revisions. But there were a lot of things that the J Standard 1 committee asked us specifically to address when we came up with the new protocol. Everything prior to this had talked about assemblies as though the underlying assumption everything was cleaned. Well, as you know, there's a lot of no clean technology right now, some of it in class 3. How do you take a section that was dedicated towards cleanliness assessment and do a no clean for that? So they wanted us to address that. They wanted us to address issues of how much can you change a manufacturing process before you have to start changing things, before you have to go back and do your revision. The ROSE test itself is still part of the specification, but in our writing, the team wanted to make it clear that it was as a process control tool, not as an arbiter of acceptably clean or unacceptably dirty. You can't say anymore, well, I'm clean because I meet the spec. That's kind of been taken away. Now, with that being understood, the team also recognized that there were a lot of small manufacturers out there, the mom and pop shops, if you will, that didn't have the resources or the expertise of a Collins Aerospace or Aqueous Technologies. So we left in what I tend to call the if it ain't broke, don't fix it option. So let's say, Mike, I'm a manufacturer and I've been making assemblies for you, and my material sets are stable. There haven't been any reported cases of electrochemical failure in anything that I've provided you for the last 10 years, then you and I can agree to keep doing as we've always been doing, using ROSE as a measure of the process. Wouldn't have to do a thing other than perhaps put that in some type of contractual agreement. You know, and in fact, that is probably one of the weak points of it as well. A manufacturer could, a customer could come back and in their process agreement say you don't have to meet the new Section 8 at all. We'll just keep doing it as we've been doing it because, of course, the purchase or the procurement document overrules the spec itself. But if they do that, then they're kind of off on their own. And if you have a failure because you circumvented the new Section 8, well, that's up to you to figure out what to do from that point.
Right.
The whole concept that we have behind the new Section 8 is to have objective evidence that the residue condition that exists on your assemblies will not lead to electrochemical failures. Some things like electrolytic corrosion, electrical leakage, electrochemical migration or dendritic growth, those sorts of things. So objective evidence is the key for all of this.
So I'm glad you said that. That leads me right into my next question about objective evidence. Who sets the standard for what is and isn't objective evidence?
Well, that's a very good question. I'd kind of like to have it, you know, it's whatever Doug says is the industry standard, but Sold. They made me take that out of the drafts, oddly enough.
Oddly enough.
The J Standard 1 has always used the term objective evidence, which is nice, but nobody really knows what that term means. So a couple of subject matter experts, I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago, we sat down and we wrote out what is now Appendix C in J Standard 1 that gives a little bit more idea of what is meant by objective evidence. The standard itself does not say who specifies what is or is not objective evidence. There isn't a level that says this is an acceptable amount of objective evidence, this is an unacceptable amount. But in my view, I think what this reflects, is, and I think it reflects the team's view as well, is that the manufacturer of the unit generates the objective evidence. If what is generated is not acceptable to the customer, then it becomes a negotiated item. Now, most of the contract assemblers that I know of, and we had several of them on our team, will generally have a preferred set of suppliers and a preferred set for manufacturing material. And generally, there's preferential pricing if you allow the contract manufacturer to use those sources of supply and materials. So they might generate objective evidence that said, here, using our current best practices, here's our objective evidence that says we are clean. A contract manufacturer will also manufacture using my sources of supply and my material sets, but it may be something that's new to them. And so in that particular case, while the spec does not say so, I would say that would probably be a shared cost between the manufacturer and the customer.
Sure.
The manufacturer would expand their objective evidence database, and the customer gets material-specific data. But I do think that it is something that should be a shared cost between the two.
Sure. Yeah, those can be worked out in the contracts, I guess. So just so that I can make sure I'm clear and our listeners are clear, if an assembler has been using a specific method for measuring contamination on their assembly, whether it was an industry recognized method or a homegrown method, and I'll get into a homegrown in a moment, assuming they've collected the data from those tests, can that test be used to satisfy the objective evidence requirement of the new standard?
Well, I'll give you my favorite engineering answer. It depends.
I knew that was going to be there.
Yes, you knew it was coming at some point. The preferred approach to generating objective evidence for the new standard is to use some form of temperature humidity bias testing, surface insulation resistance testing, which is a way in which you would identify electrochemical risk. IPC 9202 would be one example. You know, that being said, I know that many companies have used ion chromatography, and I'm a big believer in IC testing, but they've used that to set their manufacturing processes to determine what is and is not an acceptable level of cleanliness. It's much better than a Rose testing from that standpoint. And there are a number of companies that are out there right now who can help a manufacturer in that respect. The problem that I often have with something that is purely a chemical characterization, if I were to say to you that I have 0.75 micrograms of chloride per square centimeter, you might reasonably come back and say, okay, what does that mean? There isn't really a way in which you can use that and say, here's the data and the proof that this will not that this won't bite me in the butt later from an electrochemical standpoint. Now, I will say that many of the laboratories and firms that do a lot of the work to quantify what residues are there often do so in conjunction with some type of temperature, humidity, bias type of testing. So let's say, Mike, that I'm manufacturing assemblies for you, and I work with one of these companies, and perhaps I'm doing environmental stress screening on my product here. And as we're doing correlation testing between what we see on ion chromatography and what we're seeing in this temperature humidity bias test, this environmental type screening. And if the combination of the two together shows that if I'm below this level as determined by ion chromatography, then I have acceptable results, then I can provide objective evidence. So again, we get back to the spec or standard does not say what is acceptable or unacceptable levels of objective evidence.
Yeah, and it really can't. And as you've heard me kind of ad nauseum preach at the various symposiums that we've shared together, there's really no, regardless if it's a new method or a historical method, there's really no practical pass-fail limit that one could broadly apply to every circuit assembly, because every circuit assembly is different. Circuit assemblies, for example, in a router housed on a server farm might get away with that 7.5 micrograms of chloride per centimeter square. Yet that same amount of residue on an oil platform or downhole or in space or in the cockpit of an aircraft or in a wearable might fail with that same amount of residue. The residue is one of three criteria that form electrochemical migration. The residue mixes with moisture, mixes with electrical current, and the three in perfect harmony grow dendrites or create parasitic leakage, or whatever the case may be. So it is really difficult for any standards-based organization to say thou shalt have XYZ volume of contamination on an assembly without asking where is it going? What's the climactic in-use environment? What's the cost of failure? What's the standoff heights on the components? What are the spacings between the components, et cetera? It is all very contextual and very relative. So that's one reason I really appreciate the objective evidence requirement, because it makes it objective to the specific part, where it's going and how it's built and all the materials that are on it. It is very objective to that part, not to another part. Objective evidence on part A may be reliable. That same objective evidence or that same volume of contamination applied to assembly B may fail within 2 months. So it is a case-by-case basis. And you know, this has helped answer some of my questions, even though we make rose testers. I've always wondered all the years, who came up with that number? And how, you know, were boards so monolithic back then? Was it just one style of board that someone felt safe putting a number out? And that changed somehow over the last 30, 40 years or 50 years? I think those numbers, as you stated, were never really meant to be a stamp on pass or fail. It's just everyone wants a number. And in our industry, we really don't like the word it depends. But the standard that has been adopted really correctly adds the familiar it depends to the calculation, because it depends needs to be there. There's no way around it, because it really does depend on a lot of other situations.
It does, but I'll tell you, one of the things that I have heard, well, two things that I've heard most often is, said, man, this is a daunting task. I have no idea how to start on this. And so the IPC has been working on generating educational type of information that might help with that one. The other one that I hear quite frequently is, all right, if I can't use the 1.56 value anymore, what one number do I put in its place? What divides clean from dirty? What divides acceptable from unacceptable? And, you know, as you said, we're to the point of there's no one-size-fits-all cleanliness requirement. It's simply too complex for that. And, yep, and it's going to be kind of tough for the first couple of years. And I kind of liken where we are right now to where we were back in 1989 when the Montreal Protocol was first implemented. You know, if you think back to that time, we were all manufacturing with high solids rosin fluxes. We were all cleaning with Freon TMS. And I will say that at that time, no one really understood the chemistries that were involved. They never really understood what flux residues could or couldn't do. They didn't understand the materials that we were working with. Well, then the Montreal Protocol came along. We couldn't use these anymore. And now people had to start doing more research. They had to do their homework to really understand what are the interactions of the fluxes with my solder mask. What type of cleaning agent do I use? Many of them went the route of low solids fluxes, the no cleans, only to find out just how important bareboard cleanliness was to reliability. Some went the case of water-soluble fluxes, only to find out that, well, despite what the salesman told you, cleaning with room temperature tap water was not the way to go. Others stayed with the rosin flux, but then took a look at other cleaning methods. For Collins Aerospace, we do a lot of aqueous cleaning here with a saponifier for it. We do have a few no cleans, but most of what we do is cleaning here. And so just like back then, we had to work to understand fluxes and cleaning solutions and their impacts on the material. So we're going to have to do a lot of research, a lot of work to understand what are the effects of residues under difficult components like QFNs.
Right. Well, there is a motivation to do that. Yes, it is a lot of work. It does put the burden on the owner of the product and the manufacturer who's going to build it.
Yes.
Contractually. Yet there is an alternative, and I tell people this when I teach workshops. At the very end of the 8-hour workshop, we have a Q&A, and I always get asked, you know, give me a number. How clean should I clean to on whatever tester I'm using? And, you know, I tell them that it depends, and you get that very disappointed smirk back.
Yes.
That we all have seen. And then I say, okay, well then, without me understanding how your board is made, where it's going, what the cost of failure is, et cetera, I will give you a number, and that number is zero. Regardless of what method, zero contamination. If you have zero contamination, doesn't matter. Ship it, because there might be a million other failures, but it won't be a contamination-related failure. So as long as you know you're accurately measuring contamination, if you get a zero, it's a zero. So you have two choices. You can either clean to zero, whatever that means, or you can quantify how clean is clean enough, and that's exactly what the standard seems to do. It is not how clean is clean, because that's a different answer for you, Collins Aerospace, than it is for Hartz, the electronic flea collar manufacturer. They probably have a higher level of tolerance for a number of reasons, because their cost of failure is lower. Collins' cost of failure is on the news. Hartz' cost of failure is an itchy dog. So they're going to get different numbers. Without that contextual objective number, the only other number that makes sense is zero. And then you don't have to worry about where it's going. You could put the flea collar in space and it would survive. You could put it on a dog and it would survive. So, you know, there is motivation, I think, for people to go through this new standard and adopt the objective evidence and ask those hard questions that perhaps people weren't asking before because they were relying on a number established a long time ago. But it will make their product better. It will make their product certainly more reliable. Let's talk a little bit for a moment about those usual suspect historical cleanliness assessment methods. And they include SIR, which I know is quite popular, and there's standards on that for bare boards. Ion chromatography, which is one of your favorites, is also one of my favorites. The only downside of it is it's expensive. Most people aren't doing it in-house. Unless you're a Collins Aerospace or a major company, you're generally sending that out as an outsourced test, and that can be expensive. So I like to use that as go there when you know something's wrong. If there's an earlier indicator that something changed in the process, definitely go out for ion chromatography, because it can tell you not just how much, but what the contamination is, so you know where to look. Rose testing, visual testing. I warn people all the time about visual testing, but sometimes what you see is not harmful, and sometimes what you don't see is there. You're just not seeing it. But visuals, you always have to look. That saying, it's amazing what you see when you look, really works in that context. There are flux reactivity tests, little agents that change color on the presence of flux. That doesn't necessarily mean it's too much, but it does show something that you might not otherwise see. And then one of my favorite, you'll never find in a standard, it was one of our customers that bought a cleaning machine, and they are a manufacturer of professional sound equipment that's on stage. Several popular musicians use this particular brand. I won't name the brand, but they had a problem as they went over the years from tubes from vacuum tubes to solid state through hole, from through hole to surface mount. The boards they were buying were getting smaller. They didn't need them to be smaller. You know, this equipment is very large equipment. They could have a very large assembly in it. However, just modernization, miniaturization just led the boards that they were putting in these things to be smaller. And they started having a feedback problem or a fidelity problem. There was a problem with the quality of the sound. People like me may not ever have heard that, but they heard that because they're professionals. So they suspected it could be a contamination problem. So they sent us boards. We cleaned them, and then we offered to subject them to all sorts of testing. And they said, no, we don't even understand testing. We'll know if it's clean through our own method. I'm like, cool. What's your method? Well, we just get into a sound room and close the door and plug in and jam. And we can tell if the boards are clean by the sound of the quality of the sound coming out of the speakers. And that's what that was their sound of clean. And since they didn't have a reliability problem in terms of longevity of the product, it was just the quality problem. I would presume that even under the new standard for cleanliness assessment, that could probably arguably comply, because they have data. They know the one thing they're concerned about is quality of a sound, and they know if it's clean by the quality of the sound, and they've recorded that data. So I'm not sure if everyone can do a sound test, but I like to tell people to find their sound of clean, whatever that means, and adopt that, and then base the objective evidence off of the whatever sound of clean they have. Does that make sense?
It does. Certainly that would, under the new standard, that might be considered as the objective evidence. It's one, of course, that would be very hard to quantify. In that same situation, you know, I might take take the assemblies that represent here these sound clean and do ion chromatography on them. Determine what my residue levels are and in what amounts, what's there. And I might do then a number of ones that perhaps intentionally are produced with a lot of residues to them and say, all right, this is the sound of dirty, and compare the two different data sets. Yeah. So I might have a more quantified objective evidence as to what is the difference between clean and unclean, something that I, as a manufacturer, if they are my customer, then I might be able to better control my manufacturing process so that I am consistently hitting the sound of clean.
Sure.
There are a lot of different ways to go about the same thing.
Yeah, their sound test is kind of like a Rose test. A Rose test can be used to flag something that's changed. In this case, their sound can be used to flag something that's changed, and then they can go back to the ion chromatography or whatever other benchmark test they've used to compare the contamination quantification that was flagged by a bad sound or a high number on a rose test or a change of color on a flux reactivity test or something spotted under 50x magnification or whatever the case may be. You have the process monitoring tool triggering an event which causes them to dig deeper and do the more thorough, albeit more expensive, yet more thorough tests to flag and quantify the contamination that's present.
Yeah, the problem that I would have with the scenario that you put forth is that I can't really determine whether or not my products are clean or dirty until they get shipped to the customer. And the customer, you know, goes into their jam session and said, yes, these are acceptable, or no, these are not. You know, as a manufacturer of these, I would want to do a lot more work up front trying to quantify what target I need to hit, what tests do I need to do, what metrics do I need to control so that I am consistently hitting that one.
I'm going to throw in one question before my last question.
Sure.
And you kind of touched on it earlier. There's a lot of companies that switched way back in the 80s and 90s to what I like to call low residue flux, what's popularly known as no clean flux. I don't like to call it no clean because no clean sounds like an instruction. You know,
no clean is a process choice.
Yes.
Low solids is a materials characteristic.
Yes, that's true. So with people still use no clean, and we're seeing, we do polling a lot, and our polling is a little bit skewed because we're polling people who have signed up for cleaning workshops and reliability workshops, so that it's not really a perfect sample base. However, we're finding that at least in those groups of people, a little more than half of those assemblers reacting to the poll are cleaning no clean. No clean has become, at least in the mindset of many manufacturers, cleanable, where not too long ago, people were hesitant to clean no clean because they thought they were failures. They were doing something wrong if you had to clean something that said no clean, like it says do not clean. But that mindset's changing a little bit. But one of the important things, as you pointed out, is if you're going to run a low residue or a low solids flux and not clean it, you better know that your boards, your incoming boards, are clean. Because one of the things that we stopped doing when we as an industry adopted a no clean process, literally no clean, is we stopped cleaning everything. And I feel very opinionated today, but one of my other opinions is let's stop calling it a defluxing process. Let's call it a cleaning process, because flux is just one of the usual suspect residues we're trying to remove. We're also removing board fabrication residues and component fab residues and human residues and process residues in the assembly plant. Then we're adding flux on it as a matter of good measure. And so when we don't clean the flux, we don't clean anything else. So what I heard you say before, and I just kind of wanted to revisit that, is the importance of clean. If one is not going to clean their assembly after reflow, there is a great importance that the assembly itself, before anything was populated on it, be clean, because it's the totality of all of the residues that create the possibility of electrochemical migration failure mechanisms. So do you have any recommendations? Has anything changed, I should say, from an IPC standpoint on the assessment of bare board cleanliness?
To answer that question would probably be a master's thesis.
How about the community college version?
All right. What you just described as a manufacturer cleaning a no-clean flux describes Collins Aerospace. We do that all the time. And every once in a while, I'll get one of our senior leaders who's read an article in a magazine about all of the money that you can save by eliminating your cleaning step. And I've got a long list of things. All right, if we do that, we now have to start implementing controls on our bare board. We might have to start implementing IPC 5704, which is IPC's bare board cleanliness spec by ion chromatography. There is work in the IPC's bare bore cleanliness assessment task group of working that into the mainstream documents like IPC 6012, but it is not there yet. You have to start taking a look at how clean are your components coming in the doors. You have to take a look at all the residues that come into contact with your board all throughout the manufacturing process. And when you start taking a look at all of the controls and the cost associated with implementing those controls, suddenly the glamour of no clean processing tends to evaporate. I would say, though, both Mike, you and I have both been part of the SMTA and IPC's cleaning and coding conference, which is held every 2 years. It was held in Chicago this last November. And what has often been said in that conference is that people had gone to no clean, but now many of them are starting to come back to cleaning simply because, you know, we've taken the same assembly. Now it's in half of the footprint. Things are getting lower to the board, and things that we could do reliably 10 years ago with no clean, well, maybe now we can't. You know, bottom terminated components seem to be having fits in that area.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of testing yet to be done.
Agreed. So my last question is there anything else that you would like to add regarding the new cleanliness standard? Any misunderstandings or misconceptions you want to bust or anything like that? Anything that you think it would be important for our listeners to hear?
I can't really say that there have been any misunderstandings so far, simply because the spec itself has only been on the streets since last October and probably has not been put into place on many contracts yet. The IPC is somewhat frozen comments against that until our meeting in Raleigh in June. The Rhino team is going to start meeting soon to see what comments have been put in so far against the Amendment 1 to see if we can help explain that, which we will do. And I would say for all of the listeners out there, first of all, you know, be patient. The team that I lead, after satisfying our original charter, we're going to be taking a look at comments and questions. I've put together a three-hour workshop that I've done both at IPC and SMTA. I'll be at the SMTA Europe's conference on harsh environments in Amsterdam in early April, and we'll probably be speaking on this. But this is going to require a lot of education, and people need to be clear on what type of questions that they have. One of the things that I've seen in the J Standard 1 group as well is that oftentimes people want the spec to read a certain way, not because of a technical issue, but because this is how we choose to do business issue. And I want to be able to separate out those two. I want to be able to answer a technical question, but I don't really want to get into you need to do your business a little bit differently. So with that in mind, in order to help us make this a better spec, to explain those areas which still need explaining, is that people should send their comments and their suggestions, their questions to Teresa Rao at IPC, and Teresa is the liaison for the J Standard 1 group. And with her as the focal point, then she will direct those to me as the leader of the Rhino team, and we will try and have all of those answered as best we can. You know, I realize that a lot of people out there want to have that one number back again. You know, they say, Doug, you know, all we really want is a simple test that's easy to run, that works on all types of units, and is free. Well, you know, that's kind of neat. You know, I'd like to have a Ferrari that seats 7 adults, 500 horsepower, 100 miles per gallon, and costs less than $10,000.
Sign me
what
up.
What do you think my odds are?
Yeah. About as much as everyone going for zero on yes. contamination. Excellent.
Well, even if they're going for zero on the contamination, you know, I look at a value of zero, which I see every once in a while. And the question that comes to mind is that, well, is it really zero? Or do I have a residue there that simply isn't dissolving in the extract solution in the time or temperature that I want to look at?
Yeah, we're the same way. We don't like getting zeros because you have the customer look at you with a suspect view. It's like, no, seriously, it's zero. Yeah, and you're right. It may not be zero. It may just be zero detected, which doesn't necessarily mean zero, zero. Doug, I want to thank you so much for carving out your very valuable time. I know how busy you are and being part of Reliability Matters. I really appreciate all the effort that you've invested into our industry through IPC and your enthusiasm to share with your fellow engineers. And I should remind people, you mentioned this, if you're one of Doug's fans and he has thousands, legions of fans, and you want to see him in person, he and his colleague, one might say partner in crime, Dave Hillman, will be presenting at brother from another mother.
Right. Yeah.
We'll be presenting at the Electronics and Harsh Environments Conference presented by SMTA Europe on the 2nd through 4th of April 2019 in Amsterdam. That's not Amsterdam, New York. That's the real Amsterdam. My apologies to those in Amsterdam, New York. Not that you're not real, but it's Amsterdam, Netherlands. And that is a great event. This, I believe, will be the third year of this event, if memory serves. And it's growing every year. I was fortunate enough to be there last year and present, and it's all about reliability in harsh environments. It's excellent. And whenever you have a chance to see Doug and his colleague Dave perform, and I say perform in a respectful way because they're not your typical IPC type presenters. Their slides are engaging, I dare say funny and humorous and equally informative. So Doug shares that gift along with Dave Hillman to present.
And Dave and I have been described as the Abbott and Costello of technology.
Well, I'm not even going to try and guess who's who. Who is Abbott and who is Costello? But you guys, that's good. You actually get a lot of takeaways from it. So anytime you have a chance to see them live, even better. Doug, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate your willingness to be part of this.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure, Mike. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Well, that's another episode. Thanks for listening to Reliability Matters. If you like what you hear, please be sure to give us a like. Just click the like or heart button below. If there are any reliability-based questions you'd like to have answered or specific topics discussed, let me know. I can be reached at mike@mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. Don't miss another episode. Subscribe to Reliability Matters on iTunes or follow us on Spotify. You can also listen to us on iTunes, Spotify, AqueousTech.com, PCBChat.com, Spreaker.com, or our newest affiliate, Ascendo Reliability, on reliability.fm, a site dedicated to all things reliability. Once again, thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with another episode of Reliability Matters. In the meantime, keep doing it right.